Welcome to Nikonian's podcast number 4. In today's episode, we travel to Pennsylvania in the United States, where our very own Jeff Bishop had a chance to sit down with travel photographer Bob Crist. Bob Crist is a freelance photographer who works regularly on assignment for magazines such as National Geographic Traveler, Smithsonian, and Islands. He's been to all 7 continents and has won awards in the Pictures of the Year, Communication Arts, and World Press Photo competitions. So without any further ado, let's send it right over to Jeff Bishop and his interview with Bob Crist.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for giving us this interview.
My pleasure.
How did you get started in photography?
I was a hobbyist. I bought a camera when I was in college because I was part of a theater company that got a grant to tour Europe, and I was saving up for a stereo. And this is before Walkman and before iPods, and I knew I didn't want to carry a speaker and turntables around Europe, so I bought a camera instead. And I lived in Europe for a couple of years working with this theater company on this grant and kind of teaching myself photography. One of the other actors was an avid photographer, and it became like my hobby. And over the years, when I got out of college, I was working in some regional theater companies and doing photography on the side now, headshots for actors and actresses and production stills for theater companies and that kind of a thing. And I was a long time in between jobs, and I was up in New Jersey where I grew up, and I was desperate for some money. And a friend of mine who I grew up with was a reporter for a small paper called the Hudson Dispatch in Union City, New Jersey. And they were looking for photographers, and I was desperate for money. So I went down there and they gave me a tryout, primarily because I wore a suit and tie to the interview. They gave you a 3-week tryout, and during those 3 weeks, I had the most unbelievable luck for newspaper photographers. I was stumbling onto fires, an emergency plane landing, all this kind of stuff, and I just happened to be there. So they hired me after 3 weeks, and then I spent the next 5 years learning how to do the job they hired me for, kind of on-the-job training. They thought they had the idiot savant of news photography, because I really didn't know what I was doing, but I tended to show up at places where things were happening. So it was a real interesting introduction to professional photography.
I guess it is. Half presentation, half luck.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, the luck had a lot to do with it. And then, you know, I was self-taught all the way along. I taught myself when I first got the camera. I read every magazine. I read every book. So I'm a big, you know, big one on self-teaching. So I was a decent technician by the time I got the newspaper job. What I had to learn from the other staffers was, you know, just how to handle people and how to work quickly and all that kind of thing. And that took a couple of years. And I made some mistakes, but you can afford to make mistakes on a small newspaper as opposed to working for a major magazine or something.
Yeah. What was your first camera?
My first serious camera was the much beloved Minolta SRT-101. I paid $232 for it. It was the camera I took to Europe. I had a 135 and a 28, and with those three lenses, you know, and that camera, that's the basic kit I started my newspaper career with. I added a second body and a longer lens, but that was my the good old Matchneel Minolta manual camera.
What was your first Nikon?
My first Nikon, I switched to Nikon in the early 80s, and my first Nikon was the FE2 FM2 series. So, you know, back when all the Nikon guys were using Nikkormats, I was still a Minolta guy. And so when I switched over, it was to that FE2 thing. And so the FE2s were my main cameras, and then the 8008s, and then the F100s. And now the D200s look like they're going to be my main camera. I've had one of the top of the line system camera, but I prefer smaller cameras. I prefer to have more and smaller, cheaper cameras. I'd rather go halfway across the world with 3 8008s than one F4 because, you know, just the odds. I like to work with 2 camera bodies, mm-hmm. and the odds of dropping a camera, you know, when you have, you know, one big heavy camera, it's tough for me. Now, I know some people love the top of the line. They love the big hefty cameras, but I like them nice and, you know, the smaller the better.
I still have an FE2. I love the thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's a great camera.
It is.
It's actually kind of modern by today's standards.
Yeah, yeah. I tell you, when you go back and you look at those, they're so much simpler than anything that's out there today. And photography was so much simpler, too, I think.
So when did you become a professional? And what made you turn pro?
Well, you know, as I explained, I was in between jobs as an actor and I needed money. So turning pro was something, you know, that, it was a monetary thing that I needed as a young guy. That was in 1976. I got my first job at the paper. I stayed until about 1980 and I've been freelancing since 1980.
How do you approach a scene? Do you have a particular method you use with a new subject?
Well, I'm always looking to tell picture stories, so I usually try to think like a cinematographer. I'll start with a wide view of what I'm shooting, and then I'll go in for some medium views and some close-ups and that kind of thing. I like to explore a situation with different lenses and different angles and everything, just to get almost anything I cover like as a picture story, and then usually the lead picture comes out of that is the strong picture. So my approach is very cinematographic. I teach a lot of workshops, and I always tell my students, if you really want to know how to visually tell a story, watch a television show of drama with the sound turned down, and just watch how the director moves from big shots to medium shots and paces and does all that stuff. And that was, for magazine work and telling stories with pictures, there's no better training than the movies or television to show how to, you know, tell a visual story. And that's basically what I'm thinking all the time when I'm shooting.
That's interesting. My wife is actually starting to notice the lighting.
Yeah.
On
oh, yeah.
Television works. I never thought of turning it down the volume.
Well, if you turn down the volume, you're forced to concentrate on the visuals and you lose the narrative. You know, and so you just watch how they cut back and forth and how they pace it, when they start, you know, always start with the establishing shot of the hospital or the police station, and then they cut inside and there's Briscoe and Green talking, and then they go back out on the street and it's a little wider. And, you know, the whole thing becomes like this visual story just with the mix of shots and how they framed them and stuff. So, you know, we're all pretty visually savvy from years and decades of watching television and movies. We know how to tell visual stories, but we just don't realize it.
What do you look for in a subject?
Well, I look for three elements in a photograph. Something that has great color, good composition, and a sense of moment. You know, what's happening in that frame at that moment that didn't happen right before or won't happen in the next second. It's something, you know, if you're going to freeze a moment to present to a viewer, what's special about that moment? So it's color. And color could be light, too, you know, great light and color, good composition, good strong composition, and a sense of moment. What's happening in that frame that's special and should be isolated? And those are the three elements that I always try to capture. I very rarely get all three in one picture. I could probably count the number of home runs that I get maybe on the fingers of two hands every year, you know, but that's what I aim for. If I get two out of three of those elements, it's usually good enough, you know, but I aim for all three, and when all three come together, it's a portfolio picture, you know.
What do you see as your trademark?
I don't know. Good, strong storytelling, color pictures of faraway places, I guess, would be that in a nutshell. I don't really know much more than that, what my trademark would be. I know that, you know, I'm a reliable professional who you can send almost any place that'll overcome problems and get publishable pictures.
What makes your images different?
Different from these days, different from a lot of what's out there is that they're usually in focus and properly exposed. as I said, earlier, there's a lot of shtick out there, the so-called good bad photography, you know, where it's overexposed, it's cross-processed and that kind of thing. What makes my pictures different? I don't know. I think I work for the weather. I work for the good light. I'm patient. I go back to places time and time again. How different that is than from other working professionals in my field, I don't know. I don't know how different it is from the great, you know, overview of what's going on today with professional photography. It's more traditional photography. It's more you know, good color, that kind of thing, and less shticky, I guess.
How has, I don't say your style, but I guess back to your, how has your style changed over the years? What are you doing differently now than, say, 10 or 15 years ago?
Well, I mean, you know, digital has moved us all into a whole completely different way of working. And my style, I don't know how much it's evolved with digital. I take more chances now that I'm shooting digital than I did with film, trying to, you know, be a little edgier and that kind of a thing. But it's still the same thing I've always aimed for, you know, a good strong color, good composition, and just plain storytelling pictures. I have, as I mentioned before, fooled around with some different techniques with this grainy look for the Tuscany book that I did. And I've been fooling around with the little lens baby with the limited depth of field for some of my food photography for some of the magazines that I'm doing. But basically, my style, maybe it hasn't evolved that much. It's just kind of hopefully gotten more refined, but hasn't changed drastically. I mean, you know, I went from news work to corporate work to editorial travel. And in that way, things changed. But throughout those different categories, I've tried to still maintain that same, you know, good color, sharpness, that kind of thing. Clean compositions, real clean. I like clean, uncluttered pictures. And that hasn't changed. I've just, you know, started to fool around a little on the edges with some different techniques. And, you know, digital, because of the immediate feedback, you can take chances and risks and see if it works right away. And when you're 5,000 to 7,000 miles away from home, you know, on a job, it's nice to have that kind of immediate feedback. Well, did my underwater pictures work? Oh, yeah, they worked. So I can breathe easy now, you know. So then you take, you know, you take more risks. So in that way, I guess, you know, the digital has allowed me to become more of a risk taker.
But for the most part, it seems like you got it right in the first place, and now you're looking at, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
That's a very good way of putting it, yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm not looking to change horses at this point in the stream. You know, what I've done has served me well. It's a classic type of approach to what, you know, and there have been styles and that have come and go in the sense of my career. You know, there are photographers who are hotter and got colder. You know, and I just keep plugging along, and that's okay with me. I'm a plugger.
What has been your most challenging photographic assignment?
Well, man, that list is a long one. I guess shooting Iceland for National Geographic was a really a huge challenge, to try to capture the personality of an entire country in a very rugged country, you know, in a series of pictures. It was especially difficult for me because, you know, I'm a Jersey boy, a city boy, and up there it's wilderness, 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 you know. And so I'm a little out of my element in the wilderness. And huge parts of Iceland are wild and you know, that kind of thing. So that was a challenge. But every place presents a challenge of one thing or another. And, you know, with travel photography, it can be something as simple as getting sick when you're on a job. You know, everybody gets some tourist tummy every once in a while. Well, if you're on vacation, it ruins your vacation. But if you've got a week to shoot a city, you know, in Mexico, and you're sick as a dog for 6 of the 7 days, the challenge becomes, you know, very real. So each assignment has its own set of challenges, and it's tough for me to say the most of anything. You know, one of the other questions I get a lot, and I don't know if it's on your list, but what's my favorite place? Well, I always say, well, as a true travel photographer, my favorite place is the next place, the place I haven't been. Every assignment has challenges, and every place has something that interests me.
Have you ever had a significant equipment problem on location? And if so, how'd you deal with that?
Yeah, I've had some problems. I remember a job in Barbados where on my first day, a waiter knocked over my 80-200 and my I think it was a 8008 at that point, and they both smashed to the ground, and I had to shoot a job without a telephoto lens, you know, for the rest of the week, which was really hard because I depended a lot on that lens. Now, since then, I always take a backup of my two main zoom lenses. I always carry a smaller, cheaper 70 to 300 and a small, like 24 to 50 to back up my main zooms, because there's nothing worse than being, in a place for a week without half your lens arsenal. Other than that, you know, knock on wood, I've been very lucky with I haven't had too many major meltdowns of equipment. I've had some computer issues. I've had a computer go south on me. The power adapter just stopped working, so I had an hour of power to get through a three-week digital assignment, which I solved because I'm an Apple user, and this was when I was traveling place to place all over the world, and Apple, you know, is not a popular brand outside the United States. I just solved by hanging out in the lobby of hotels and seeing if anybody was trying to use their Wi-Fi on their PowerBooks, and then bumming power, you know, adapters to charge my batteries and stuff. So now I take two of everything, including two laptops when I travel, two chargers. I take backups for everything because I am, you know, you name it, it's gone out on me at one point. But because I do travel usually with spares, it's not a big deal. But probably that time I lost the tele lens for a whole assignment was probably the worst that I can think of.
I guess life teaches us lessons over and over until we finally grasp.
Exactly. And you know, Murphy's Law, being the operative law of photography, is that you'll never need a spare if you carry it. But the minute you leave your spare behind, forget it.
That seems to be how it is. When you get a creative block, how do you overcome it?
Sometimes the best thing for me with a creative block is just to forget about photography for a while and do some crossword puzzles and read a good novel and just let myself calm down again and come out. Sometimes you get to a location and you look at it and there's nothing there that excites you or interests you, and you wonder, how the hell am I going to make an interesting picture story out of this place if nothing excites you? And you got to kind of dig deep then and say, look, you got to come up with something. You're a professional, you know. But if it's really a creative block, I usually just kind of either hit some museums and just look at some old painters' works or something like that, or read a good novel or do some difficult crossword puzzles, just something to get my mind off it and let things percolate, you know, through. And then eventually it comes back. But I've had places where I've been where I've said, there's nothing I like here. And if I don't like a place, it's really hard for me to do my work. And it's really been tough. But fortunately, there's only been a couple of those places I've been in a long career. So I've been lucky.
Now, photography is a business. How is the subject topic of a book chosen?
You know, books are usually labors of love on the part of the photographer, because picture books are a very bad business. I've done several of them, and they're fun to do. They represent a large body of work, but they very rarely make you a lot of money. So you gotta love what you're shooting. So usually my book subjects have either arisen out of a subject matter that I find fascinating and just wanted to do, whether I was going to get paid or not, or a place that I've got a great body of work collected over the years from other magazine assignments. So books come from different things, but books are probably the least profitable undertaking in a money sense for a photographer. But it's great satisfaction to see a collection of your work between two hardcovers. The book that really has done it for me was working with Frances Mays, the lady who wrote Under the Tuscan Sun, on this book called In Tuscany. It was a bestseller, and it was, you know, it's very rare for a picture book to be a bestseller. I like to think it was because my pictures were so good, but I think it was because Frances Mays' name was on the cover, and she's a proven bestseller.
Do you have any plans for a new book?
I'm doing a how-to book now on digital travel photography, actually. But I don't have any coffee table book plans right now. I'm working on a book on digital travel photography, but it's a how-to book where I write, and the coffee table books I usually just do the pictures for. It hasn't been finalized yet with the publisher, but it's pretty much there, and I've got the outline, and I'm working on that. But no other plans for coffee table books at this point.
How many people do you use when you're taking a picture? When you go to a location, do you have people that you're working with?
The only person or entourage or helper that I might have on most of my travel jobs is when I get overseas. I usually, if it's a place that I don't speak the language, I usually try to hire a translator, guide type of person. He or she doesn't have to be a photo assistant, but the kind of person I look for is somebody who's, you know, smart, street smart, speaks my language and the native language, knows the lay of the land, and can get me into places where I might not ordinarily be able to get by myself as a tourist. So we call these people fixers, you know. They're kind of like locals who are street smart and translate. They don't need to know the dates of when the cathedral was built, but if they know the guys who are playing cards in the bar, and we can get in there and get some shots of guys playing cards in a bar in Corsica without getting knifed, you know, that kind of person is valuable. So I don't use photo assistants. I don't take photo assistants with me from the United States to go overseas. Most magazines won't pay for that. But I will hire, you know, and depending on the country, it's a translator, guide, driver. Sometimes they're all rolled into one. For instance, you would never want to drive in India by yourself because it's a minefield, you know. So you need a driver, guide in India, and usually it's pretty reasonably priced. You can get these guys, and if you find a good one, they're very valuable because they have a feel for what you're looking for, and they can get you into monasteries and, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for. Whereas, you know, if you went up to the front door of a monastery in Burma and you knocked on the door and said, "I want to come in and take pictures of the monks," you know, most of the time they'd say, you know, "Get lost." But if you have a local guy, like the guy I used in Burma, he took me to the monastery where he spent 3 years of his life. And it was Old Home Week, and we got in and I was having lunch with the monks, and I was able to spend a whole day in a monastery thanks to working with a local fixer. So that's the kind of help I use when I can afford it. And even sometimes when I can't, I'll go out of my own pocket, because it's so important to get beyond the tourist kind of view of a place when you're doing travel work.
You do the same thing, the tourist, but you have more insight.
Yeah, you get more of an insider's view, and that's what magazines are looking for. You know, if they wanted a bus tour kind of view of a place, there's a million people that they could hire a lot cheaper than me to shoot it. But if you want to get inside, there's a certain ability that magazine photojournalists and travel photographers develop of worming their way into other people's lives, getting invited out on fox hunts in England or into monasteries in Burma. You know, it's almost more important to be able to ingratiate yourself into the life of the country that you're covering than it is to be a great photographer, because it's FA to be there. You know, it's like news photography. You got to be in the right place at the right time. A lot of times the pictures will take care of themselves, you know, but it's the being there that's the hard part, you know, being in the right place at the right time.
What lessons do you think your students' clients have learned from you?
What my clients have learned from me?
Students or clients.
Oh, students, what? Yeah. Well, I hope that the students have learned, you know, at the workshops that I've taught over the years, to learn to really get to know a place, do a lot of research, try to engage with the locals, and not be like a trophy hunter. I kind of make a differentiation between tourist photography and travel photography. There's like a kind of been there, done that, trophy hunting kind of mentality that you see in a lot of advanced amateur travel photographers. They just kind of go and they shove their cameras in front of people's faces, and, you know, in places like Asia where you can do that and nobody will hit you back, you know, and without really, you know, getting to know the people and trying to slow down and get a feel for the place. So what I hope any student comes away from a workshop with me, a couple of technical tricks, a couple of, you know, technique things, but basically really learn to know a place, to appreciate it, and try to show that in your photographs.
What is your favorite, most used lighting method?
Oh, I'm a big natural light guy, my first option is always to do it in natural light, but I'm a big fan of the smart flash units that Nikon has, you know, the the current manifestation, the SB800 with the cordless TTL flash, is just fantastic. This technology is just hit such a great stride, and you know the control that you have, and it's seamless. It's just amazing, and not having to be tethered to a cord. You know, I travel with about three or four of these things, and you just wander around, you know, with the cordless thing, and it's just amazing. It really is really special for me. So I love that system, I use it more and more because it's easier to use. You know, the easier something is to use, and the quicker it is, you know, the more you use it. Being a travel photographer, I'm always on a tight budget and on a tight schedule. So I can't spend an hour and a half lighting a pub, but I can't spend all day lighting something. I need to hit as many situations as I can in a day when I'm on location. So something like these cordless strobes are just, you know, a great time saver. And being able to check your exposures on the back of the camera, it's a whole new world. Mm-hmm. It's the part of digital photography I love.
What is your favorite photographic location? What makes that location special?
Well, I don't have one favorite. I have favorites for different things. For landscape photography, I like Iceland and Italy, Tuscany especially. I've just come back. I have a cover story in the current issue of National Geographic Traveler on the South Pacific, the French Polynesia, Bora Bora, Morea. And I'm big on that place now because it's just so beautiful, the water and the islands and the people are so lovely to photograph. So, but as I said earlier, my favorite place is always kind of the next place, the place I haven't been. But I do have some, you know, Italy is a place I go back to a lot. Iceland I go back to a lot. I love the American Southwest for landscape work. The problem is it's so heavily covered that nobody ever does stories on it. And nobody ever buys stock pictures of it, or not from me, because there's just so much out there. But, you know, I love to go out to Bryce Canyon or something like that and just shoot some landscapes. But I know they'll never appear anywhere because there's just too many of them. It's supply and demand, you know. Yeah. I can sell more pictures of downtown Philadelphia 100-1 than I can sell over of pictures of Bryce Canyon or Grand Canyon, because hardly anybody shoots Philadelphia, and a lot of people go there, and there's a lot of stories about Philadelphia. Everybody goes to the canyons, and nobody writes about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you compose in camera, or do you crop later on?
I look to shoot as much as I can in camera. I don't plan on cropping. You know, I've been a 35mm guy all my life. I've shot some medium format, but the different head of shooting 35mm is to use every square millimeter of real estate that you have on that chrome, and that hasn't gone away. So I'm not opposed to cropping something if it makes it better afterwards, you know, if I've somehow screwed up. But I generally like to compose as much as I can in the camera.
Try to keep as much that negative as you've got.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, that makes sense. Any special filters or anything like that you use while you're in the field?
Well, I use a warming polarizer quite a bit. Singray has a couple of interesting polarizers. He's got a polarizer that has a warming filter built in, which I like because I found a straight polarizer tends to make things look so cool. I use filters much less since I've gone digital than I did in the film world. A graduated neutral density filter is something I still use in digital because I'm still not that good with Photoshop about, you know, taking a sky from one place and putting it in another thing. I'd rather get it all in the frame, and digital, like slides, has a very limited tonal recognition range. Mm-hmm. So I use that graduated neutral density filter as much, if not more, than I did when I was a slide shooter with digital to hold skies and stuff. But I'd say those are the two main filters I'm using now, polarizer, warming polarizer, and a graduated neutral density filter.
Okay. What tips can you offer for somebody considering publishing their work?
Well, I would say shoot a story or shoot a place, something that you really love and you really know a lot about, and then look for magazines that do the same kind of stories. And I would also advise to start regionally, not, you know, this is another bit of advice I give to a lot of workshop students. Don't, you know, go to National Geographic with your first story, because, you know, you're competing with hundreds of the world's best photographers all scratching for a story. Why, unless you have some absolutely unique access or point of view on a place, go to some place more regional, like, you know, Philadelphia Magazine every year does spring getaways in the mid-Atlantic. So, you know, and they're always looking for pictures of, you know, interesting places. You know, shoot a little story on Cape May and go to Philly Magazine, or if an airline magazine adds a new destination on, if Southwest Airlines comes to Philadelphia, you know that eventually Southwest Airlines Magazine is going to do a Philadelphia story. So you know, you try to work, you know, shoot a story and then place it in a place that would have interest, but that you're not going to be, I mean, every magazine, every level, airline magazines included, is highly competitive. But you have a better chance with a small regional magazine. Like there's, I live in Bucks County here. There are three magazines in Bucks County. So if I did a little story on a little Bucks County winery or something, I could probably get it published in one of those magazines. Whereas if I took that same story and tried to get it published in National Geographic Traveler, they probably wouldn't be interested in it, number one, you know, and that kind of thing. So my advice is to think locally, think regionally, and build up your credentials before you go in and get your head handed to you on the big national magazines. Because I tell you, I've been working a long time for those magazines, and it gets harder, even when you have a reputation and a track record, it's damn hard to get their attention about anything.
Which camera bodies do you currently use right now?
Well, I'm in a period of transition from the D70s to the D200s. I have a couple of D200s that I just took delivery of, and even as we speak this afternoon, I'm going to be going out testing them and everything. And you know, I've programmed them the way I want them to work, but I haven't taken a frame with them. But it looks to me like my favorite all-time film camera was the F100. To me, that was the camera that I would have happily worked with until I dropped over. It was a camera it is a camera that had everything I wanted and nothing I didn't. It was compact in size, but fully loaded with all these things and stuff like that. And I'm thinking that the D200 might be that equivalent for me. 10.2 megapixels, it's really big enough for anything that I'm going to need in my world. My world is basically 11 by 17 inches, you know, publication, or maybe a little bigger for a coffee table book. But I've seen 6 megapixel pictures, you know, I've made 24 by 36s that look pretty good.
Uh-huh.
You know, but there is, you know, some clients want a little bigger file. So I'm thinking, looking at the camera, the way it's laid out, the way it's built, the features that it has, combined with the 10.2 megapixel sensor, this could be the camera for me.
Do you miss Velvia? The 50-speed Velvia?
Oh, God. I miss film. Like, I miss it so much. Because it was finite. It was there. It didn't have to plug in anything to look at it. You know, I always joke, too, that, you know, I'd love digital photography if at the end I could get a whole set of nice little slides of my selects that were as good as, you know, my Velvia slides. Then I'd have something I could look at, and I could send the scans off to whoever needs them. But I miss the physicality of film. I miss the finality about it. And I miss the fact that I could give my film to a lab and let highly trained experts deal with processing. You know, and then I could take those beautifully processed chromes and give them to a printer and let a highly skilled pre-press and color management guy do it. Now, I'm those guys. You know, and honest to God, I'm not a genius with color management and pre-press. You know, I've struggled with Photoshop and all these kind of things. But I've had to make myself expert in color management, pre-press preparation of slides and sharpening and all this kind of stuff. Nobody told me about this back in 1976. All I needed to do then was get out and get good pictures and let the rest to the other professionals. Now we're expected to be not only image capturers out in the field, but, you know, pre-press and image preparers. And I kind of, that's the part of digital photography I resent. It's more work for me. It's less time I can spend out in the field. And that's what I miss about film.
Okay, Bob, that's our interview.
Oh, okay.
I would like to thank you very much for the interview. Before I came up here, I was telling my buddy that I'm going to go to this interview and I'm going to talk to you and I'm going to come out ahead. I'm going to learn something. I will be all that much better. This poor guy I'm interviewing, he's not going to get anything from talking to me.
Well, that's not true. That's not true. You always, you know, it's always good to have a conversation with another photographer. You always pick up something.
Well, thanks, Jeff, for that great interview with Bob Crist. From all of us here at Nikonians, thank you for listening to our podcast. Be sure to download all of our other episodes at podcasts.nikonians.org. Nikonians.org, we're the worldwide home for Nikon photographers, so check us out on the web and join now. It's free.